Call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. I think we do have a quorum present. And the first order of business would be to consider the minutes. I think members have in their packets or have been distributed minutes from both October 30th and November 4th. Chair would entertain a motion for the approval of the minutes from October 30th. Representative Gunther, thank you. Approval of minutes has been moved. Are there any additions or corrections? Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. And again, the minutes from November 4th, which in fact was the joint meeting with the Civil Justice Committee considering the bill that we have before us today. We do need a motion for their approval. Perhaps someone who was in attendance at that meeting. Representative Bly, thank you. Any additions or corrections to those minutes from November 4th? Seeing none, all those in favor of their approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Now, the next order of business being that this is the first meeting of our 2010 session would be to introduce new members, at least one of the two new members being present. Representative Fortman, welcome to the committee.
We're Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Looking forward to a number of lively discussions that I'm sure you'll be happy to participate in. Now, Representative Seifert had requested to be added to this committee when he went in search of some new work to do, having relinquished his position of minority leader. But I guess we'll have to welcome him whenever he chooses to show up. In addition, we have our pages to introduce. Actually, back from last session, we have Luke Ledbetter. Luke, thank you. Welcome. And also, Mike Devane. Where is Mike? We'll have Mike say hello when he gets back. Luke, would you like to remind us of your background? And keep it brief.
I'm a former page and elections official in my halftime. I graduated in 08 from the U of M. That's it.
Glad to have you back, Luke. Bill that we have on the agenda today is House File 1182, which is Representative Bly's bill dealing with public service corporations. Members, I should say, and as a preface to taking testimony on this bill today, Representative Westrum has proposed an amendment to the bill. It did, in fact, fail to meet the 24-hour deadline for amendments by about 23 hours and 45 minutes. But I think it's something that certainly needs to be considered, and I think it needs to be considered in this committee. Likewise, I think Representative Welty is planning on offering an amendment to the bill that is substantial. And while I would propose to discuss both of these amendments today, it's my intention to lay the bill over since we have not had made it possible for other concerned parties to be aware of these amendments and have an opportunity to testify, particularly the right-of-way amendment, I think, is something that there will be concern about. And I think it does need to be heard in this committee. So rather than move the bill forward and then ask to have it come back here at a later date, what we'll do is try to, as far as possible, exhaust the testimony today and lay the bill over for a vote on the amendments and the bill next week. And Representative Seifert, we just did welcomes of new members and pages in your absence, but welcome to the committee. We're happy to have you as a member, and I'm sure you'll find it interesting and challenging subject matter.
I'm excited to be here, Mr. Chairman.
And also, I attempted earlier to introduce our new page, Mike Devane, in his absence. Mike, if you would like to just say a word or two about how you came to be here. And
well, I just...
You don't need to go back very far for that.
I basically finished school in the summer, and I was looking for work.
All right. What school did you finish in the summer, Mike?
UW Superior.
Great. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Hilty.
Tell us about your bill.
Yes. This is a bill concerning the eminent domain laws that were put into place in 2006. And when that happened, there were some exceptions put in place for public service corporations. In 2008, a concern of a property owner was brought to me dealing with the Mincan pipeline coming through their property. And in a few minutes, I'd like to have Russ Martin come up and talk a little bit about that. And then I'd like to move through three testifiers who've worked with property owners in the past about the issues around protecting the rights of property owners. I think this particular bill, it's clear to me, has to do with making sure that property owners, that citizens in Minnesota are treated fairly in the process of eminent domain seizures. And not that we're trying to stop a project or limit, but just make sure that there is a process in place where property owners can feel that they have gotten a fair deal. So without further ado, if I could have Russell Martin come forward and speak to you about his experience.
Mr. Martin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is Russell Martin. I live in Scott County, which was crossed by that Mincan pipeline. I was one of the property owners who were affected directly by it. And initially, I really have no hard feelings about having a pipeline. I know that that's a part of the processes that we have to have in order to live and survive as civilized people, I guess. But the way that the project was presented and the way that the property owners were treated when it came time for the actual taking of the properties and the routing of it was very disheartening, to say the least. The process started out with a presentation that there was going to be a pipeline and that it was going to cross the property. And the next step shortly after that was that I was presented with a offer to sign, which would mean that I accepted the conditions. And in that presentation, there wasn't even a dollar value on it. It was just open-ended. So I said, I don't think that I should sign or accept a contract like that. I have to at least have some information. So they came back again, it was sometime later anyway, with a dollar value on it. And it didn't seem like it was quite appropriate for what was happening. During that time, though, I had went back and I thought, okay, now we have just went through an eminent domain revision of the laws here in Minnesota. Prior to that, I know it was horrible. My father went through an eminent domain case, and that didn't work out very well. And I was going to be involved in one, and I didn't quite know how it was going to work out, but we had changed the laws. So I went back to review them. And when I read through that, and it's a long document, and I'm not an attorney, so it takes me a while to read through these things. And it seemed like the law was at least somewhat fair until I got to the part of the exemptions. And I really had no idea how we were going to work through that, but there was parts in there that said that the condemning authority or whoever it might be, in my case the pipeline, would negotiate and at least do some in faith correspondence. Anyway, when it came down to that, when they did bring the offer with the actual dollar value on it, it was take it or leave it. That was it. 3 years later, we have it resolved. But they had the pipeline in there 2 years already by the time it was done. So when you think or you hear people say that projects are going to be stopped or slowed down because of a hindrance in someone working through the eminent domain process, that's not true. Also, that condemning company or public service corporation in this case has to do is the filing of the paperwork in the local courthouse and the project moves on. You're left in the dust and you're left to work with the good faith negotiations that they have, which in my case were none. And they force you into the court system. If you guys want to alleviate some of these cases from being in the court, you have to have a system that makes the person who's trying to take the property at least work with the person who owns the property. And the way we have this set up right now, that's not happening. And there is no incentive for it to happen. In my case, the pipeline company let me have to go through the court process, which I really had no idea how to do that. You have to get an attorney. You have a lot of expenses. When the thing was finally done and settled, I had to go get appraisals. The appraisal that I got for just the trees that they removed from my property was almost the same dollar as what they offered to take the property. So they had no consideration. I live on a dead end road, and I'm the first house on it. In order for them to see the other properties, they had to drive by my place. If they had done any research about appraisals, they would have seen and at least made note of some of the things that were there. But they didn't. They chose not to do any of it because they aren't required to do it, and there is no penalty for them to not do it. I don't know what else to say, but other than this law has to be at least rewritten to the point where, as a property owner, you have a recourse to at least recover some of the costs that the person who's taking your property should have done their own homework in the beginning. I don't understand why I have to, as a property owner, get certified appraisers and other people to come and defend the price that I feel is fair, and I can't even recover those costs. So I end up never, ever getting the fair price. Because we take that and then we start subtracting from that all the costs you incurred. And you end up with, in my case, 3 years later. Anyway, it didn't work out very well for me. I was not happy. that's what led us to seek our representatives and our senators to help us through this process. We didn't know where to start. At least we have someone that was willing to hear us and start us in the direction that hopefully can be accomplished. I'm not an attorney, so I don't really know what else to say. Thank you.
Mr. Martin, before you leave, are there any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you.
And then I'm going to have Rod Press, Don Smick, and Paula McAbee join me up here, and then they'll each do their testimony.
Chairman Hilty, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you a bit about my experience in the last major project that involved a, quote, public service corporation. As you're aware...
Mr. Schmick, before you continue, would you please identify yourself for the record?
I apologize. My name is Rod Crass. I practice law in Bloomington and do a significant amount of condemnation work and have over the years, both for municipal and other governmental entities as well as property owners. And as I was indicating, had a great deal of experience in the condemnations that took place in what has been called the MNCAM project, which affected 1,100 Minnesota property owners as an oil pipeline was built through western Minnesota down through the southwest portion of the Twin Cities and around to Coke Refinery. This is essentially a Coke Refinery project. And back in 2006, the legislature passed a series of changes, amendments to the condemnation law, which made it much fairer for property owners and gave property owners some rights that they never had before, and many would say long overdue rights. I have listed in the submittal I've given you those seven rights for which an exception was written for what was designated as public service corporations, which essentially meant all of the private profit-making utilities that operate in Minnesota, as well as municipal utilities also, but primarily the profit-making utilities. And they were exempted from these seven additions to the law that you saw fit to impose on the state of Minnesota, on 87 counties, on, what, 1,000-some cities, urban townships, school districts, any governmental entity that had condemnation authority. And the list, I thought, was important for you to understand what exception has been given to these profit-making utilities, and you will see them in Part B of the handout I have prepared, number 1 through 7. And the first one is what I call the lowball penalty, when condemnation, when those with condemnation authority make offers that turn out to be too low, as found by the condemnation commissioners that get appointed by judges to handle these cases, there's a penalty. And the penalty includes attorney's fees, costs, expenses that relate to the need of somebody like Russ Martin, Russ and Judy Martin, to go ahead and have to appear through this process in order to get fair compensation. The next particular exception was the requirement for appraisal and negotiation. This, I will tell you, is a method of losing me business, because if people with condemnation authority get appraisals, good appraisals to begin with, and sit down as the law requires and negotiate with property owners like Russ and Judy Martin, there's going to be a lot less condemnation hearings, a lot less, if you wish, court involvement in projects like this. There is the third exception is the petition and notice, the requirement of condemning authorities to let people know what's happening with regard to a potential condemnation that impacts their property, that they have certain rights, including the right to challenge whether or not the project should occur and how that needs to be done, things of that nature. The fourth exception for the profit-making utilities deals with the loss of going concern. If the government takes your property and causes your business, causes you to lose your business, to go out of business, there is a provision that in 06 the legislature put in that requires some compensation for that. And for some reason that I haven't yet determined, in fact, I don't understand why any of these exceptions apply to profit-making utilities, that too is an exception. The next one deals with some minimum compensation. That was number five. Number six was a limitation that the condemning authority can't require the property owner to accept a return of his property as part of this process. The last one is very interesting. It deals with uniform relocation assistance. And the federal government 50 years ago passed a system of compensating people when they have to relocate, and virtually all states have adopted that even when federal money isn't involved, so that people get compensated when they are forced to relocate. But this is an exception to again these profit-making utilities. I was here 2 years ago to talk to a different committee, and a representative that I happen to know, Mike Beard, asked me, well, in the matters that you're handling for the coke refinery condemnations, what have you found with regard to this issue of whether or not that penalty for lowballing would actually have applied? And at that point, I didn't know. We were still in the process of proceeding. Well, I've given you a list, and these are all from the public record. There's nothing private about them. That happens to include the gentleman you just heard from, and tells you with respect to the quick take amount, which is the last written offer that that Coke Refinery made to all of my clients. I have 51 clients in this Coke Refinery condemnation. What they made and what the final settlement and award was, if it went to hearing, and you can see the percentages. And remember, under the law that was passed 4 years ago, if the difference was 20% to 40%, the penalty may be imposed by the court. If it's 40% or more, must be imposed. And you can see the percentages here. The highest one I had was 1,133%. That was negotiated. The highest one I had that was decided by the court-appointed commission is 816%. Every single one of my clients would have been eligible to receive that penalty. So why, you ask, would Coke Refinery make lowball offers? Because it works. 1,100 people had property that was required by Coke Refinery. 850 signed up before the condemnation hearings began and the process began. 250 went through this condemnation process, and the rest bought into whatever they were told by the companies that get hired by folks like Coke Refinery. And there's a couple major national companies that provide land agents and projects like this. They happen to be from Texas and Oklahoma. And these folks come up, and most of my clients testified that they had two, three, or four different land agents knocking at their door. One would come, they'd talk with him or her for a while, they'd disappear, and number two would show up saying, I don't really know number one or what he said, let's start talking now, and people just got tired and got worn down. But there is no question when you look at these numbers, and my 51 people, keep in mind, are about 20% of all the people in the coke refinery condemnations that went through the condemnation system. So this is a pretty good cross-section of what has happened and why you ought to consider taking these exemptions away. The issue here is who's going to pay the cost of these projects. They're for the public. If it's MnDOT, they're for a road. It might be for a park system, if it's a county, or a sewer system, if it's a city. Who should pay the cost? Shouldn't it be all those who partake in and use the project? Or should the poor landowner who happens to be in the way of the project bear some of the cost? And that's what's happening here. By saying to Coke Refinery or CapEx 2020, you don't have to pay the full just compensation that we, the legislature, has determined is available for people when the government takes the property, you're telling the landowner they're going to have to subsidize Coke Industry or CapEx 2020 by paying some of those costs themselves, costs that they would be reimbursed if it was the government that took their property. And that's the issue here. Why should the amount of just compensation a property owner receives be dependent on who takes their property? But that's the nature of this statute as it presently exists, because if it's a public service corporation, an interesting name for profit-making utilities, but if it's a public service corporation, the landowner can absorb some of those costs that the government would pay if it were the government taking exactly the same property or exactly the same easement. And consequently, I'm here to urge upon you to make level this playing field, to make certain that when your constituent's property is taken, that they will receive the full measure of just compensation you decided in 2006 was appropriate, and they'll receive that irrespective of who it is that's taking their property. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kress. Are there questions for this witness at this time?
Thank you very much.
Ms. McAbee?
My name is Paula McAbee, and I live at 1961 Selby in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I represent Citizens Energy Task Force in connection with the CapEx 2020 projects, and also represent an individual family that is likely to be affected by the CapEx projects in Hampton and the Midtown Greenway Coalition, that's a nonprofit group involved with the Power Line project in Minneapolis. I don't do condemnation cases. This is not going to affect my bottom line. If you remove the exemption, there's not $1 of those attorney's fees that I'm concerned about. What I'm concerned about is this is a pretty unfair system as it is. People come and testify at public hearings all over the state that they feel that the system is unfair, that the utilities have lawyer after lawyer, staff person, expert after expert, for which they pay for, citizens across the state, with their rates. And when they want to get up and say, you're affecting my property, you're affecting my farm, you're affecting my family's dream, they don't have the resources. And even if the utilities settle on their property and choose to take it away with this exemption in place, they don't have the resources to have fair compensation. I also want to suggest this is not a Democrat or Republican or a rural or a suburban or a rural or an urban issue. It affects everybody. The case I'm working on, the CapEx case, the Brookings Power Line, It goes through very, very rural areas. It goes through areas where a person's only asset is their land and they're living on a fixed income. And just down the block is somebody else who has a very successful business and a very profitable estate. It affects, I'm looking at the little section of land on 220th Street where my client lives, and there are people on fixed incomes. There are people with very substantial resources, and they live next to each other. And this also affects people in the inner city. I'm not sure if you're aware of it. Xcel Energy now is trying to put 115 kV high voltage power line right through the middle of South Minneapolis. If that's approved, and if that goes forward, they have plans to connect that and drive that power line, 115 kilovolts, out through the western suburbs. They even have a plan to put a 345 kilovolt line right through the heart of Minneapolis. So there can be all kinds of homes and businesses that are affected. I want to give you just a little bit of an indication from the testimony I'm hearing. What I think what we heard last year is the power line companies coming in and saying they weren't like the Coke refinery, so we didn't have to worry. That's not what's coming out in the testimony. The representatives from CapEx are getting up in public testimony and saying that even if the easement goes across somebody's property, the full length of somebody's property, that they're relying on research saying that it will only affect your property value from zero to the, at the very highest, 14%. For many people, they're saying, even if you, I've heard several members of the public say, if you put this power line through, it's going to affect my business. That's a going concern. One person has a photography studio. They moved out from an urban area to Dakota County, bought a beautiful piece of property, spent over $160,000 in building landscaping features, aesthetic features, and that's how they make their earnings. They do photography that's primarily outdoor, families, landscape. They did a survey of their customers. 93% of their customers who responded to the email said that they would be concerned with a high voltage power line over this property about their safety. And 88% said a combination of concerns about health and the aesthetic problems caused by 170-foot towers, that it would make them less likely to use this business. Now, the owner of the business asked the utilities, what kind of compensation would you give me if I went out of business? And the utility got up and said, none. It's not our problem. On our little stretch of 220th Street, I know of two families that are likely to have to move. One is a family with three kids under the age of six, and their house would be right now between 50 and 75 feet away from the power line. They looked at the research on magnetic fields, which suggests that there's a risk of childhood leukemia if the magnetic fields are 4 milligauss. The magnetic fields in her home would be more than twice that. So the issue about relocation and can I find a comparable property is important. There's another family that has a child daycare, right near the high voltage power line. And even if the woman who runs the daycare is not sure if high voltage lines are unhealthy for those little children, if any of the parents who are sending their kids are, that might mean that her only business is she's a home daycare provider, that her only business may cease to be a viable business. So even if the strip of land or the square footage needed for the power line towers isn't that big, depending on the impacts, depending on the nature of the property and the business, people may be forced to locate. Their going concern businesses may no longer be a going concern. And I think, as we saw in the pipeline case, the question of fair appraisals affects everybody. I had a few people call me and they said, we know what other people in this community, how much per acre their land is, but the pipeline company refuses to give us an appraisal. They're giving us a certain amount of money offer and they won't tell us where, and they won't show us an appraisal that's signed off on by a licensed appraisal that says there's a reasonable basis for it. Now, not everybody can hire a lawyer. Not everybody has the money. I had one client who is dying of cancer. And he was trying to make sure that the people who came after him as kids got adequate value. But needless to say, going in for treatment, it was not the highest priority to hire a lawyer. So a system that doesn't allow people to get appraisals, doesn't allow people to get information, is a system that means that a powerful company, whose lawyers we're all paying for, can prey on people who have fewer resources. And I think that's a system that has to change. And there's nothing that I've seen in connection with the CapEx 2020 project that suggests that leaving it up to the good graces of the power line utility companies will lead to any fairer or better result than it did with the Mid-Can pipeline. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for this witness? Seeing none at this time.
No. One other thing, Chair Hill, did you want us to comment at all, sir, about the proposed amendments as well, or is that not on the table right now?
I believe the amendments are have been distributed, and I think it probably would be appropriate to go ahead and comment on them, although they have not actually been introduced or described. I was not planning on doing a formal introduction of the or motion on the bill or the amendments, but being that they're quite simple, and I'm sure you can describe it adequately, why don't you go ahead and give us your observations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just briefly summarize. We received from Representative Bly some potential draft language, which I believe was authored by League of Cities folks. And that language would say that the exemptions would not apply to high voltage lines or pipelines subject to the certificate of need. And I am somewhat sympathetic to the idea that municipal corporations may have a better system of accountability than, let's say, the CapEx 2020. But I would caution that the language has to be much more careful, because it's this language that at least I saw doesn't cover everything. Because we want to make sure that if a person's farm is taken for a substation as opposed to the power line, that they would get the right to have an appraisal and an attorney and relocation assistance if they need it. So we need to make sure that it covers substations as well as transmission lines. And also, as we discovered in the pipe, in the power line that's going through South Minneapolis now, if power lines are shorter than 10 miles in length, even the 115 kV high voltage lines may be exempt from certificate of need. So we want to make sure that it's a high voltage line even if it's not under the certificate of need, so we don't have a situation where you put in short power lines little bit by little bit and avoid the responsibility to properly compensate people. And I think we also want to make sure that aspects like substations, which come along with the power lines, that people who are not deprived of their right to a fair compensation just because they happen to be at the substation end. So even if there is a need to work more on this issue with the League of Cities, I think we need to make sure the language is not so narrow that it causes real serious inequities. So that's one amendment. I looked very briefly at a series of amendments that I think were proposed by the utilities that are sort of attempting to, they look like they're attempting to go back and redo what was done in 2006. And that, to me, just looks like stacking the deck in favor of the company as opposed to the citizen even more than it's stacked right now. And I would certainly hope that if utilities want to try and reinvent the wheel, that they do it as a separate bill and not try and do it as part of this vehicle. Because if utilities are trying to reinvent the wheel and shift the burdens, one thing I would certainly suggest that this committee consider is, at this point, ratepayers pay for the attorneys for CapEx, for Excel, no matter what, whether the route they propose is fair or unfair, whether what they propose to compensate citizens for is fair or unfair. And if they want to redo the system, then at least we should take a look at, are there circumstances where the route they propose is unfair and it's not selected, the compensation they propose is unfair and it's not selected, that the investors in the company rather than the ratepayer should pay all those continued and ongoing attorney's fees that were used to fight the citizens of this community. And then there's one, I think there's one other proposed amendment. I haven't seen it in writing, sir, but I think you mentioned that Representative Westrom was looking at the possibility of saying that routes need to be on right-of-ways. And one thing I would caution, I think for the my experience is for the most part, putting a transmission line on a right-of-way often reduces the human and environmental impacts. But sometimes those right-of-ways are really skinny two-lane streets. And sometimes the place where the street is where all the people live. So that if one were to go a mile away on a field line, one would impact just a handful of homes, whereas on the right-of-way, that's where all the homes are clustered or all the businesses are clustered. So I would suggest that the way it is in rules now, where non-proliferation and staying on the right-of-way is an important consideration, but avoiding homes and avoiding businesses and avoiding churches and avoiding wetlands are also important considerations, and that if the legislature were to say that right-of-way is always the consideration, sometimes more homes, more businesses, more churches and other cultural institutions and more really vulnerable environmental features would get impacted. And I think that that would be a mistake. So that was my three comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Kras. Is that how you say it?
Thank you. Yes.
And it's about the pipeline, and if this isn't directly related to eminent domain, then I can talk to you offline after the hearing. But when the pipeline, when they take your property and put the pipeline on it, what are the ramifications for if there's a spill? I know in the second week in December, there was a 210,000-gallon spill. And so what is the right now, the way the law is written, is there a continuing obligation for the company to pay for the devaluation? Because I have to imagine if the pipeline breaks, I have to imagine this is oil. And so it potentially damages the groundwater. Are they exempt from paying the reasonable value of the damage that occurs from any breach of the pipeline?
They are not. They are obligated, in fact, to take care of the damages that result from a spillage or a break or an accident in the pipeline, which is always a possibility. The ancillary question to that is, are they obligated to pay for the devaluation of the property because of the possibility of that spill? And their position consistently is no, that doesn't exist. There is never any devaluation of the remaining non-taken property caused by the pipeline, even though the possibility of that spill exists.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions at this time?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Schmick. I'm a commercial real estate appraiser. I've been in this business for about 24 years, and I have a little bit of experience with condemnation with public service corporations. Now, Mr. Kras talked about a couple of the things that I was going to talk on, so I'll try to move through these. The last hearing, we heard a lot about how it's an open process. People can come and talk and everything about the projects. Well, what we're talking about today is after the certificate of need, after the routing permit, now it's time to come and take your property. And that's the process we want to deal with. Now, these exemptions, what exactly are they exempt from? Appraisals and negotiating in good faith. How does a property owner make an informed decision on what's being offered if he has no understanding of what that offer is based on? If the goal of negotiations is to reach a point where both parties can agree, why do you withhold information that is useful to the other side to understand and be able to negotiate? As it is right now, and no offense to any job group, but you can have a janitor put down on a piece of paper, I'm offering you X number of dollars, and that's the offer. There's no uniform standards of professional appraisal practice being invoked. There's no basis being offered for these numbers that are being offered. As Mr. Kras indicated, you get multiple right-of-way agents, and some of them are from out of state, and that is a very common practice. First guy comes in and says, well, I'll promise you the world. Second guy comes in and says, well, I don't know what the first guy said, but here's what I'll do. Third guy comes in, and he doesn't know what the first two said, and he makes different promises. And in the end, the property owner is left totally confused, frustrated, angry, and has to start spending money on attorneys and appraisers to figure out what's going on, just to get the information he needs to make an informed decision. Now, you're going to hear the argument that it costs too much to get appraisals. Well, I can tell you in my industry that if you walk into an appraisal firm and says, I need 200 appraisals and I'll pay you $1,000 apiece, you'll have every appraisal firm in town trying to get that job. But that's from the condemner side. What does the property owner have? He's got one appraisal, and he can't get it done for the $3,000 that's mentioned in here. Sometimes he can't get it done for $5,000, sometimes not even $10,000, depending upon the nature of the taking and the complexity of the taking. The other thing that you'll find out is that these offers are never really quite clear about what's being taken. We want to take an easement. It's 50 feet wide, and it's going to cross your property somewhere in this area. Well, that's fine, except that these right-of-way agents have a tendency not to look outside the easement area at what consequential damages there might be to the remainder of the property. You get an appraisal report, and that's going to have to be considered. But if there's no requirement for an appraisal, there's no requirement for them to look at all the possible angles of this taking. So how do you make an informed decision? You can't. And that's why you end up in litigation half the time just to find out what the offer is based on and which offer. Attorney's fees. Oh, I might point out, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has a requirement for appraisals. And I have a statute here. It's 84-something. Here it is, 84.0274, Landowner's Bill of Rights. Minnesota requires the Department of Natural Resources to have an appraisal before they can even talk about acquiring somebody's property. It is the right of every property owner to receive an appraisal when an offer is made. It spells out the responsibilities of the Department of Natural Resources. You must have an appraisal before you can go and talk to them. Now, that's the Department of Natural Resources. They're using taxpayer money to buy parkland and flowage easements and things like that. The process we have for the Department of Transportation and all the cities and counties that we have, you get an appraisal, you go make your offer, you sit down, you have a basis to talk about what you agree with and what you don't agree with. And I can tell you from experience that if you start with two appraisals on each side, you can eliminate half the arguments and just focus on what's important. And we're seeing more settlements and less litigation because of the system we have in place at the Department of Transportation. You're able to narrow down the issues instead of having to argue about everything when you get to court. Attorney's fees. Public service corporations don't like to pay a lot of unnecessary fees, and I will tell you that if you look at the laws in the surrounding states, the requirement for reimbursement ranges anywhere from 10 to 20%, and there's no marginal bracket after that. If the final settlement exceeds the offer by 10 to 20%, it's automatic, you get your expenses paid. In Minnesota here, we've got that optional bracket between 20 and 40%. We have a very weak law when it comes to that area. But having said that, that only kicks in if the damages are $25,000 or more. So when you're talking about very small takings, that really doesn't come into play too much. It's only on the big properties and the big projects where that comes into play. So when you hear the argument that, well, we have a lot of small takings and we shouldn't have to pay all, they're already protected. So why do you want to exempt them from their own protection? The, let's see. Okay, loss of going concern. I think it was 2006, the legislature created the current rules, and loss of going concern is now compensable. But there's an aspect of that that I don't think has been touched on yet. When you put a business out of business, a lot of times they're going to have a business loan. They're going to have loans on commercial or industrial property. If there's no compensation for putting these people out of business, you are, in fact, creating a situation where you're going to put some people into bankruptcy because there's no way to pay off those other loans if there's no compensation. We don't need more unemployment. We don't need more bankruptcies. So eliminating the loss of going concern, I think, is a terrible situation here. We need to compensate these people so that there isn't a ripple effect that goes on into their communities and their households. Minimum compensation. They want to be exempt from minimum compensation. That means that the compensation they get is at least sufficient for them to get a comparable property to move to and continue on in business. We want to make property owners whole. That should be the whole goal of this, is to make property owners whole so that they're not suffering a disproportionate cost of these projects. If you exempt them from that, then the PSCs, when it's time for somebody to move, can say, well, you can take any old building. It doesn't make any difference if it's adequate or not. It's just, here's a replacement property. Go make it work. That doesn't work. I mean, you're going to still put people out of businesses if they can't find adequate properties to move to. Now, the current law is kind of interesting. If you're a city, county, state, the reimbursement for appraisal fees is $1,500 on one- and two-family homes. PSCs, it's $1,500 for any kind of property. And I can tell you that's not going to get the job done. Typical commercial appraisal today on even a small warehouse is going to run you $4,000 or $5,000. You get into some of these complicated office buildings and you're up $15,000, $20,000. Now, it doesn't make any difference to me, because my contract is going to be with the property owner or with their attorney. And that's a contract that will be enforced, and when the case is over, I will get paid. The only question is are you going to reimburse the property owner? Appraisers will always get paid. How bad of a dent, an economic dent, are you going to impose on these property owners? How badly are you going to beat them up with this economic club? That's what has to be decided here. It's $3,000. Isn't going to get the job done. Now, I mentioned PSCs hire outside firms. If they don't control those outside right-of-way firms, you're going to have all kinds of abuses. They are not PSCs themselves. You don't know what's in those contracts when they're hired. You don't know what incentives are built in. Go acquire this route for me. Don't spend more than $2 million. If you come in under budget, we'll pay you a bonus. Well, you have built-in incentive to go out and abuse people. That's not ever been brought up in any of these hearings, when they hire outside people to do this work for them. I mentioned at the last hearing, what this law does is create a subsidy for profit-making companies. Your cities, your counties don't have it. Anybody else with the power of eminent domain does not have this clout. Why in the world would you insist that the government act properly when they're using taxpayer dollars and not insist that a profit-making corporation go out and do whatever they want? That makes no sense to me. The citizens of Minnesota deserve to be protected and treated fairly. Now, the only people in this room that can do anything about this is you. the committee members. Judges can't fix this. Nobody else can fix this but the legislature. And it is such an easy fix. Delete or repeal. It's a single word, and all you have to do is vote to repeal it. And everybody's on a level playing field. Same rules, same for everybody. Now, one of the interesting things about one of the amendments that is being proposed, and I think it says that if it goes through the Public Utility Commission, it's exempt or something like that. Well, if you read between the lines on that amendment, they're basically saying exemption is based on size of the project, which automatically raises the question, if some projects don't need the exemptions and some do, why do any of them? It's a tacit admission that they don't need these exemptions. It's all about the subsidies they get by pushing these true costs onto the individual property owners. And that's what's at issue here. Are we going to make them pay the full cost of the project or not? And these costs aren't big. The acquisition of property and the amount of money that we're talking about is not going to add more than 1 or 2 or 3% to their project costs. And if their project can't absorb the cost of fairness, then those projects should not be approved. They're just not economically viable if it's going to take that little change to put them underwater. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, question. Your last statement, you talked about raising 1, 2, 3% of the cost. Is it your opinion that this bill would raise the cost? And therein lies the inherent reason the current law is in place? Or some of your testimony and others has been it would narrow what you're fighting over and you wouldn't have as much suing going back and forth and so much courtroom. Is there a chance that this bill would actually lower the cost if it reduces conflict, or do you think the reality is it still will raise the cost?
No, the reality... Thank you. The reality is that they've never been paying the true cost of their projects. They have been subsidized by lower project costs by not having to pay fair value for these properties. So ultimately, yes, the whole project will go up in cost. But on the other hand, there will be a savings through litigation, less litigation. You go out and get appraisals on everybody and say, here's the basis of what we're offering you. And I can tell you with the Department of Transportation and the cases that I've been working on, they receive their offer. They sit down with knowledgeable people and they go through it and they say, well, you know, they missed this sale or they missed that sale or, you know, that makes sense, this doesn't make sense. The parties come together and say, look, we agree with this portion of it, we don't agree with this portion of it, and here's why. You have dialogue going on back and forth, and eventually those issues get resolved. It's only when you have differences in appraisal theory, most of the time anyways, on unique property types, where you still have to go forward into litigation because you really do need a judge to decide who's right and who's wrong on the methodology used to appraise it. But when you're talking about land values, that's not rocket science. You miss a sale, you don't miss a sale, you bring them to the table and say, here's what we'd like you to consider. Okay, we'll consider it. We'll meet you halfway. Deals get done. Litigation goes down. But in order to do that, you got to start out with a basis of saying, we're going to be fair, we're going to recognize all the project costs, and yes, it's going to cost us a little more, but we're going to spend less time in court. And these projects will never get held up because they have the quick take provision. They file in court, judge says, here's title, go do your project, and I've had some cases that didn't get settled until 6 years after the project was done. But yes, project costs will go up. For the first time, they will be required to recognize their true cost. Thank you.
Members, we still have three people on the agenda that have asked to testify today, so we really do need to move on at this point.
Thank you, lawyer. Hey,
Representative Bly, are these your witnesses? Did you have a preferred order? Or two remains? Mr. Johnson, Ms. Ruland,
I don't see Robert Johnson here, and I'm not sure Teresa Rulon, that's not someone who I know, but Craig, I did have a conversation with Craig Johnson last week, and I know that he would like to testify about the viewpoint of the League of Minnesota Cities, so he could certainly come forward and talk about that.
Mr. Johnson, if you would, and Ms. Rulon. Okay. And Ms. Rulon, I see you are here. We'll get you up next. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. And I want to thank Representative Bly, Chair Hilty, and a couple other members of this committee for putting a lot of time in with me over the last week to try and address some concerns on this. I just want to start by clarifying one aspect of this bill. The exception for public service corporations that was inserted in 2006 was not for for-profit utilities. It happens to include some. But if you read the definition in 117.025 of public service corporations, you will see that it includes gas, electric, telephone, cable, co-ops, natural gas pipelines, crude oil or petroleum pipelines, any municipal utility that includes wastewater, stormwater, any other utility a city may offer, any municipal action operating a municipally owned utility, any joint power agreement that operates a utility, which could include multiple communities, any municipal or public airport, any common carrier, any watershed district or joint powers water organization, and any drainage authority. All of those are public service corporations, and removal of the new eminent domain proceedings exemptions for those does have a very significant effect. The exemption was put in place at the time because so many people thought that these are projects that pretty clearly are for the benefit of a very large group of people, not for one given property owner over the rights of another given property owner. And so they left, as those members who were around in 2006 will remember, not many things were left. It was a pretty clear case in this instance that there were some projects that they didn't want to add these new thresholds to at that time. And that's how that definition came to be applied to eminent domain proceedings. For city purposes on this, Mr. Chair, we have a number of concerns. When we are asked to extend wastewater service, our stormwater utilities, drinking water utilities, it is often for a public health or environmental reason. And to say that we are going to now place additional burdens and additional restrictions in the way of that occurring could cause the project to not be viable. These are not for-profit entities. They are going to have to decide whether they want to dramatically increase share rate payer fees for everyone in their community, or whether they want to let all those houses around that lake right outside the town limits continue to have failing septic systems rather than hook them onto the city wastewater system. Many times the extensions we are having to do within city limits are because of state or federal mandates that say the city has to do it. And this is saying that now on top of that mandate being required and the cost of that infrastructure being required of a city, we're also going to expose them to legal liabilities, potentially attorney's fees and a number of other things that even further complicate what is already a mandate that's being put on the city for the infrastructure costs. So, Mr. Chair, we have been working with Representative Bly. We'll certainly continue to do that if this bill is going to be laid over for further discussion to try and really limit this. The testimony you've heard already is pretty interesting, but you heard the words pipeline and high voltage transmission line, and you heard them over and over and over and over. And so one of the amendments that I believe is in front of you today brings this down to that issue. And that's what the League of Minnesota Cities is suggesting as a way to move forward on this. Is where we are seeing that there is a need to look at this further is with the siting of these particular types of facilities, then let's do that. And it's the ones that are large enough that they're high voltage by definition, 115 kV and above, and need a certificate of need, and a pipeline that needs a certificate of need. Both of those are defined by the Public Utilities Corporation. It's easy to know when a project qualifies. Doesn't matter who the owner is. If a co-op or a municipal utility was trying to do the same thing, they would also be required to meet that higher threshold. And members, I believe that would allow some comfort for the folks you've heard and some of the processes they've been involved with and had troubles with, but would leave the unintended consequences out, where we're trying to deal with water quality issues, drinking water issues, and other city public works issues. I would be happy, Mr. Chair, to respond to whatever questions I can.
Questions for Mr. Johnson. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, you mentioned that the bill, if we were to narrow it down to the high voltage or the pipeline, how many people, maybe Mr. Bly, Representative Bly or somebody else can answer the question, but how many people are specifically affected by just those two issues? And what about the rest of the people that would come into play? That are they going to be left out and be subjected to what is left in the bill? Any idea of how many people are affected by this, the KV, the high voltage lines and the pipeline?
I think
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. I think that testimony was given that there were about 1,100, is that correct, that were impacted by the pipeline? And to be honest with you, I do not know how many will be impacted by the power line directly, but it is a sizable number, and there are several lines that are being talked about in the in that. So the other concern, too, that there isn't a remedy for, but there are people who I've heard from who, although the line does not pass over their property, they believe that their property will be devalued by the fact that the power line is going over them. So there are lots of people who are very concerned about these projects going forward and are in the path of something that's going to change their lives.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is with these two issues here, but also there's also other issues that could be included that we're going to now leave out if we narrow it down. So that's just a concern as I bring it up.
Chair Hilty.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, for asking that question. And that is certainly something that I think you heard testimony from Paula McAbee, that there are some other things we need to look at. And that's certainly something I will want to sit down with Craig Johnson when we work out some details here. We do want to make sure that that all sides have a fair hearing, and we've come up with a final bill that will work for everybody. But we need to have that discussion. And there are things that that I've heard that we do need to be concerned about. It also begs the question, although Mr. Johnson has made some good points about certain projects that need to go forward and they may be impacted. It begs the question: are there any projects that shouldn't treat people fairly? And I think that's kind of the bottom line for me and why I think the issue is so important to really talk through and get right. And if you have anything more that you could add about, you know, what justification do you have to ask for these exemptions? And I don't mean to make that sound as though you don't have any. But, you know, we that's something we need to hear. We need to know.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would first of all justify that you didn't have a wave of people coming in here saying that they are being treated unfairly by their city wastewater, stormwater, and drinking water utilities. Because when we are extending service to these people and running an easement through their property to get water to them and sewage away from them, that's generally something they very much wanted. What we are very concerned about is with this situation, we have a lot of places right now where total maximum daily load requirements are being put in place, where a lake is being found to be polluted, and a requirement for new city wastewater and stormwater connections is part of what's being required to clean up that stream or lake. And this would now potentially create several new substantial legal thresholds that city utility would have to meet to be able to extend service to those areas to deal with that problem. We already have some cities that have been asked, for instance, to extend sewer service to a neighboring township that has fairly concentrated development and the septics are starting to fail and they really need another solution. And they're finding that because obviously cities try and site their utility lines under roads wherever possible, saves on getting multiple easements, the added costs of the eminent domain changes from 2006 just for roads are making it so that they're not really sure they can afford to extend those services. Because they're not ever going to make the money back. Our utility rates are not set to generate enough money to make money back to pay for those costs. We don't set our ratepayers' utilities to have a big surplus every year to decide if we want to extend services other places. So part of it is just how city water utilities run. We aren't set up for making that kind of impact, and we very seldom are extending to a place where someone isn't going to see a real property value gain probably from having that service extended to them.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, you asked a question that's right on point. My first political experience was in the mid-90s when NSP had proposed a 230 kV line through my county, and I know this number very well because I managed the database of affected landowners for a citizens group. It was in the neighborhood of 1,624 when I handed them the database off. Now, that was 35 miles, half in 20 miles in Minnesota, 15 in Wisconsin. My observation, I don't know how I'm going to fall out if the amendment were put up before us now, but my observation is that there's a much closer layer of accountability with the cities as they're doing these projects because they're elected and have locally elected boards if they're not directly managed by those councils. I think it's one of the things that we should ask as Representative Bly and Mr. Johnson proceed is what's that, how can we be certain, and what's our role in assuring that property owners are treated fairly in that process? I think that local accountability may be that trigger and that safeguard. I'm not convinced of it yet, but I think it could be.
Further questions for Mr. Johnson? Seeing none, Ms. Rowland? Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. My name is Teresa Ruland from New Prague, Minnesota, and my husband and I own property that is in the line for the CapEx power line. And I apologize, I'm not a public speaker by any stretch of the imagination, so please bear with me while I read this. I am asking for your support of this amendment to repeal the exemptions granted to the public service corporations in the eminent domain bill, House File 1182. These companies should be held to the same standards as any other entity using eminent domain to procure property for their project. I am describing what may happen to us if the CapEx 2020 line goes through our farm as a small snapshot of what is played out throughout Minnesota all too often. My husband and I live on the farm and the very land his great-grandfather purchased on February 4th, 1892. We're proud to live in the house his grandfather started building in 1904. Our farm has been declared a century farm by the state of Minnesota. Over the years, we've made many improvements to the land and buildings, but have always wanted to keep the main farm buildings, the house, barn, and shed, much the same as when his grandfather was living. We've also improved our 140 acres of farmland by tiling, maintaining grass waterways, contour plantings on the hills, minimum tillage, and adding organic matter to build up and maintain the topsoil. The farm, in return, has been good to us, and we have been able to maintain a comfortable living farming. Our son has been operating the farm with us for the last several years. We make our living on this farm and have reinvested much of the proceeds back into the farm. We thought our farm was a very good investment and had planned to derive our retirement income from it. We have maintained a lifestyle which we felt would ensure good health well into our retirement. Now, CapEx is proposing to build part of their 247-mile double 345 kV transmission line from Brookings to Hampton through our area, including through the middle of our fields, with a mile through all of our fields. In our unique situation, our farm is both a preferred and alternate route, although law states that CapEx must choose two different routes. The posts for this line are to be 175 feet high, plus a 30 to 40 foot footing. The poles will be 6 to 12 feet wide at the base. Living and working very close to these high voltage lines will compromise our health as well as our means of earning a living. Much of our income will be lost to all these structures in the middle of our farm fields for many reasons. Farm equipment is large and will be larger in the future. You cannot easily navigate around a huge dangerous obstacle in the middle of your fields. Thus, land is taken out of production. CapEx states pole impact area is 1,000 square feet. This may be the case in a roadside ditch or possibly in a lawn, But in agricultural fields where there is large equipment used, much more area is lost. 45-foot wide planters cannot easily navigate around these structures. Plus, surrounding area production decreases when it is double planted and overpopulated. You're wasting your property, and you're wasting your very expensive seed and fertilizers. Plus, the transmission lines will interfere with the GPS systems on much agricultural equipment nowadays, and that will not function. Construction equipment for the project will need to access the pole site in the middle of our fields, destroying much crop in the process of traveling and maneuvering in them. To facilitate water drainage in the spring and after heavy rains, our farm has an intricate system of drain tile, which will probably be damaged by the heavy equipment each time it enters the fields. The transmission lines are designed to operate for decades. The lines, however, will need to be inspected and repaired throughout the years of use. There are a few days of the spring, summer, and fall when there is no crop in the fields, and that means whenever they maintain or inspect these lines, much more crop will be destroyed. Another huge issue of the power lines is the health effects. Childhood leukemia, breast cancer, brain cancer, ALS, and Alzheimer's have all been shown to be caused by electromagnetic radiation. With the combined effects of crop yield reduction, the hazard and difficulty of navigating large equipment around a highly energized power line in your path while farming, the health effects, the visual and noise pollution caused by the poles will greatly devalue our 140 acres. All of the above issues would greatly reduce our yearly income. This is our family's means of earning a living. Many miles of this line are affecting prime farm fields and families like ours, as well as other businesses from Brookings, South Dakota to Hampton. I have attended most CapEx open houses and hearings, and many people have testified whose houses are close to this power line. They don't want to raise their young family under it for health reasons. People who have survived cancer do not want to submit themselves to electromagnetic fields associated with the power lines. Others have testified that MinCam took their backyard for the oil pipeline in 2008, and now the power line wants to use their front yard for the transmission lines. The completed MinCam pipeline and proposed CapEx 2020 power line are just two of the projects that will affect Minnesota property owners. There are preliminary talks of a pipeline from North Dakota to New Jersey, as well as projects transmitting wind-generated electricity to the East Coast. Minnesota citizens need to be fairly compensated when utility companies insist on using their property as a transmission corridor. Citizens should not be required to accept the low compensation utility companies offer because they can't afford to fight it with associated lawyer and appraisal fees. These companies derive decades of income from the utility, while the farmers and other business owners lose yearly income to lost production, recurring disturbance of their fields for maintenance of the transmission lines or the pipeline. These companies using eminent domain to acquire the land for their pipeline, transmission lines, etc., are far from non-profit public service companies. In doing research on them, I have found the following information. Xcel Energy, which is a 70% partner of the CapEx power line, reported 2009 generally accepted accounting principles earnings of $681 million. 2008 earnings were $646 million. Otter Tail Corporation is also one of the CapEx partners. Their 2008 revenues were reported to be $1.3 billion with a net income of $35 million. The Pine Bend Oil Refinery, located in Rosemount in Invergrove Heights, is commonly referred to as the Coke Refinery. It's owned by Flint Hills Resources, a subsidiary of Coke Industries. On the Coke Industries website, I found the following information. 1988, construction of the Wisconsin pipeline to provide outlet for increased Pine Bend Refinery. 1992. Acquisition of a $100 million portfolio from Chrysler puts Koch in the municipal finance business. By the end of the decade, Koch Financial Corp. has more than $1 billion in assets. 2004, Flint Hills Resources purchased Alaska assets, including a crude oil refinery in the North Pole and product terminals in Fairbanks and Anchorage. Koch subsidiaries acquire Invista, formerly DuPont Textiles. 2005, Koch Industry acquires Georgia-Pacific for $21 billion. 2006, Forbes magazine names Koch Industries the largest private company in the U.S. 2007, publication of the Science of Success, How Market-Based Management Build the World's Largest Private Company. It's written by Koch Industries Incorporated Chairman and CEO Charles G. Koch. 2008, the Minntown Project, a 304-mile expansion of the Minnesota pipeline system, was completed. It will deliver crude oil to refineries in the Twin Cities.
Ms. Rowland, we are running over time.
I just have one more paragraph, okay? Two more paragraphs. Thank you for allowing me to finish this.
Please try to wrap up as fast as you can.
Above, Koch is claiming the installation of this 304-mile oil pipeline is one of the company's most significant accomplishments for 2008. Part of that pipeline traversed many farms and homes directly north of us. Many of our neighbors have ill feelings toward Koch for the way they were treated during land acquisition and the extremely low price they were paid for the pipeline easement. Also, following installation, many found their fields left in an unusable condition. This law needs to be changed so landowners can be more adequately compensated for their land rights. In 2006, Koch was the largest private company in the U.S. Xcel's 2009 profits are $681 million. These companies are far from nonprofit companies striving to bring their product to the American public. They are huge, profitable companies out to make more money by using the eminent domain laws to procure their land for their transmission corridors. These companies have lawyers whose sole job is to procure easements for the least possible compensation. Striking these exemptions from the eminent domain bill will still allow utility projects to proceed while also ensuring taxpaying property owners like myself still have some rights too. This issue is very important to me, as well as to many other Minnesota citizens. A handful of property owners whose land is seized through eminent domain should not be forced to accept unreasonably low compensation for their property, while all citizens see the benefits of these upgraded utilities. Over the decades, these utilities operate the transmission corridor. The increased cost of right-of-way acquisition would be extremely small when divided between all benefiting people who are their customers in Minnesota. This issue is important to me. I thank you for your prompt passage of the amendment. Thank you for allowing me to speak, Your Honor.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Rule? Members, how I would like to proceed with this. We do, I think you have in your packets now, there was a delete all amendment that Representative Bly had in the packet, and the effect of that basically was just to reflect the action that the legislature already took in the last session on this issue. So I think that's a relatively non-controversial amendment. The other two that were discussed today and that hopefully you can give some thought to before we take this issue up are the Westrom Amendment, which would alter the evaluation criteria that are used in siting to require that the commission and siting high voltage transmission lines use existing railroad and highway rights-of-way. And the other amendment is the other one that was discussed, which would restrict the exemption to or eliminate from the exemption, I should say, any project that required the issuance of a certificate of need. I think those are the basic issues surrounding this bill that need to be resolved. Representative Bly, I know that it's your intention to attempt to resolve those with any concerned parties. And what we'll do is wait for you to tell us that you're ready to take this up and deal with these issues, and we'll put the bill back on the agenda. Okay. And hopefully that can occur by sometime next week.
That's my intent. Thank you, Representative Hildy.
Excellent. Thank you. With that, the bill is laid over and the meeting is adjourned.